Side 2. A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Venge. Continuing on page 26. He studied the creature lying on the travois, so strange yet real. And it was more than just the creature, though that was the most spectacular strangeness. Its bloodied clothes were a finer fabric than the pilgrim had ever seen. Tucked in beside the creature's body was a pink pillow with elaborate stitchery. With a twist of perspective, he realized it was alien art, the face of a long-snouted animal embroidered on the pillow. So escape through the harbor was a 1,000,000-to-1 shot. Some prizes might be worth such odds.
"We'll go down a little farther," he said.
Jacques Ramafan pulled the travois. Wick Rackscar strode ahead of him, trying to look important and officerly. With Scar along, it wasn't hard. The member was the picture of martial competence. You had to be on the inside to know the softness. They were almost down to sea level. The path was wider now and roughly paved. He knew the harbor fort was above them, hidden by the trees. The sun was well out of the north, rising into the eastern sky. Flowers were everywhere, white and red and violet, their tufts floating thick on the breeze. The Arctic plant life taking advantage of its long day of summer. Walking on sun-dappled cobblestones, you might almost forget the ambush on the hilltops. Very soon they'd hit a sentry line. Lines and rings are interesting people, not great minds, but about the largest effective pack you'd find outside the tropics. There were stories of lines 10 miles long with thousands of members. The largest Peregrine had ever seen had fewer than 100. Take a group of ordinary people and train them to string out, not in packs, but as individual members. If each member stayed just a few yards from its nearest neighbors, they could maintain something like the mentality of a trio. The group as a whole was scarcely brighter. You can't have much in the way of deep thoughts when it takes seconds for an idea to percolate across your mind. Yet the line had an excellent grasp of what was happening along itself. And if any members were attacked, the entire line would know about it with the speed of sound. Peregrine had served on lines before. It was a strung-out existence, but not nearly as dull as ordinary sentry duty. It's hard to be bored when you're as stupid as a line.
There. A lone member stuck its neck around a tree and challenged them. Wick Rackscar knew the password, of course, and they were past the outer line. But that passage and their description was known to the entire line now, and surely to normal soldiers at the harbor fort. Hell. There was no cure for it. He would go ahead with the crazy scheme. He and Scriber and the alien member passed through the two inner sentries. He could smell the sea now. They came out of the trees onto the rock-walled harbor. Silver sparkled off the water in 1,000,000 changing flecks. A large multi-boat bobbed between two piers. Its masts were like a forest of tilting, leafless trees. Just a mile across the water, they could see Hidden Island. Part of him dismissed the sight as a commonplace. Part of him stumbled in awe. This was the center of it. The worldwide Flenser movement. Up in those Dürer towers, the original Flenser had done his experiments, written his essays, and schemed to rule the world. There were a few people on the piers. Most were doing maintenance, sewing sails, relashing twin hulls. They watched the travois with sharp curiosity, but none approached. So all we have to do is amble down to the end of the pier, cut the lashings on an outside twin hull, and take off. There were probably enough packs on the pier alone to prevent that, and their cries would surely draw the troops he saw by the harbor fort. In fact, it was a little surprising that no one up there had taken serious notice of them yet. These boats were cruder than the South Seas version. Part of the difference was superficial. Flenser doctrine forbade idle decoration on boats. Part of it was functional. These craft were designed for both winter and summer seasons and for troop hauling. But he was sure he could sail them, given the chance. He walked to the end of the pier. A bit of luck. The bow starboard twin hull, the one right next to him by the pier, looked fast and well-provisioned. It was probably a long-range scout.
"Psst! Something's going on up there."
Scriber jerked ahead toward the fort. The troops were closing ranks. A mass salute? 5 servants swept by the infantry, and bugles sounded from the fort's towers. Scar had seen things like this, but Peregrine didn't trust the memory. How could... A banner of red and yellow rose over the fort. On the piers, soldiers and boat workers dropped to their bellies. Peregrine dropped and hissed to the other,
"Get down."
"What?"
"That's Flenser's flag, his personal presence banner." "That's impossible."
Flenser had been assassinated in the Republic 6-10 days earlier. The mob that tore him apart had killed dozens of his top supporters at the same time. But it was only the word of the Republican political police that all Flenser's bodies had been recovered. Up by the fort, a single pack pranced between the ranks of soldiers and white jackets. Silver and gold glinted on its shoulders. Scriber edged a member behind a piling and surreptitiously brought out his eye tool. After a moment,
"Soul's End. It's Tyrethect." "She's no more the Flenser than I am," said Peregrine.
They had traveled together from Eastgate all the way across the ice fangs. She was obviously a newbie, and not well integrated. She had seemed reserved and inner-looking, but there had been rages. Peregrine knew there was a deadly streak in Tyrethect. Now he guessed whence it came. At least some of Flenser's members had escaped assassination, and he and Scriber had spent 3-10 days in its presence. Peregrine shivered. At the fort's gate, the pack called Tyrethect turned to face the troops and servants. She gestured, and bugles sounded again. The new Peregrine understood that signal, an N calling. He suppressed the sudden urge to follow the others on the pier as they walked belly low toward the fort, all their eyes upon the master. Scriber looked back at him, and Peregrine nodded. They had needed a miracle, and here was one, provided by the enemy itself. Scriber moved slowly toward the end of the pier, pulling the travois from shadow to shadow. Still no one looked back. For good reason. Wick Rackscar remembered what happened to those showing disrespect at an end calling.
"Pull the creature onto the bow starboard boat," he said to Jacques Ramafan.
He leaped off the pier and scattered across the multi-boat. It was great to be back on swaying decks, each member drifting a different direction. He sniffed among the bow catapults, listened to the hulls and the creak of the lashings. But Scar was no sailor, and had no recollection of what might be the most important thing.
"What are you looking for?" came Scriber's high-talk hiss. "Scuttle knockouts."
If they were here, they looked nothing like the South Seas version.
"Oh," said Scriber. "That's easy. These are northern skimmers. There are swing-out panels and a thin hull behind."
Two of him dropped from sight for a second, and there was a banging sound. The heads reappeared, shaking water off. He grinned surprised, taken aback by his own success.
"Why, it's just like in the books," his expression seemed to say.
Wick Rackscar found them now. The panels had looked like crew rests, but they were easily pulled out, and the wood behind was easy to break with a battle axe. He kept a head out, looking to see if they were attracting attention, while at the same time he hacked at the knockouts. Peregrine and Scriber worked their way across the bow ranks of the multi-boat. If those foundered, it would take a while to get the twin hulls behind them free. Oops! One of the boat workers was looking back this way. Part of the fellow continued up the hillside, part strained to return to the pier. The bugles sounded their imperative once more, and the sailor followed the call. But his whining alarums were causing other heads to turn. No time for stealth. Peregrine hot-footed it back to the bow starboard twin hull. Scriber was cutting the braid-bone fasteners that held the twin hull to the rest of the ship.
You have any sailing experience? Peregrine said.
Foolish question.
Well, I've read about it. Fine.
Peregrine shooed them all into the Twin Hull's starboard pod.
Keep the alien safe. Hunker down and be as quiet as you can.
He could sail the Twin Hull by himself, but he'd have to be all over to do it. The fewer confusing thought sounds, the better. Peregrine pulled their boat forward from the multi-boat. The scuttling wasn't obvious yet, but he could see water in the bow hulls. He reversed his pole and used its hook to draw the nearest boat into the gap created by their departure. Another 5 minutes and there'd be just a row of masts sticking out of the water. 5 minutes. No way they could make it. If not for Flenser's N-calling up by the fort, troopers were turning and pointing at the harbor. Yet still they must attend on Flenser Tyrefect. How long would it be before someone important decided that even an N-calling can be overridden? He hoisted canvas. The wind caught the Twin Hull's sail and they pulled out from the pier. Peregrine danced this way and that, the shrouds grasped tightly in his mouths. Even without rum, what memories the taste of salt and cordage brought back. He could feel where tautness and slack meant that the wind was giving all it could. The Twin Hulls were sleek and narrow, the mast of ironwood creaking as the wind pulled on the sail. The Flenserists were streaming down the hillside now. Archers stopped and a haze of arrows rose. Peregrine jerked on the shrouds, tipping the boat into a left turn on one hull. Scriber leaped to shield the alien. To starboard ahead of them, the water puckered, but only a couple of shafts struck the boat. Peregrine twisted the shrouds again, and they jigged back in the other direction. Another few seconds, and they'd be out of bowshot. Soldiers raced down to the piers, shrieking as they saw what was left of their ship. The bow ranks were flooded. The whole front of the anchorage was a wreck of sunken boats, and the catapults were in the bow. Peregrine swept his boat back, racing straight south out of the harbor. To starboard, he could see they were passing the southern tip of Hidden Island. The castle towers hung tall and ominous. He knew there were heavy catapults there and some fast boats in the island harbor. A few more minutes and even that wouldn't matter. He was gradually realizing just how nimble their boat was. He should have guessed they'd put their best in a corner bow position. It was probably used for scouting and overtaking. Jacques Ramafan was piled up at the stern of his hull, staring across the water at the mainland harbor. Soldiers, workers, white jackets were crowded in a mind-numbing jumble at the ends of the piers. Even from here, you could see the place was a madhouse of rage and frustration. A silly grin spread across Scriber as he realized they really were going to make it. He clambered onto the rail and jumped into the air to flip a member at their enemies. The obscene gesture nearly cast him overboard, but it was seen. The distant rage brightened for a moment. They were well south of Hidden Island. Even its catapults could not reach them now. The packs on the mainland shore were lost to view. Flenser's personal banner still whipped cheerfully in the morning breeze, a dwindling square of red and yellow against the forest's green. All Peregrine looked at the narrows, where Whale Island curved close to the mainland. His scar remembered that the choke point was heavily fortified. Normally, that would have been the end of them, but its archers had been withdrawn to participate in the ambush, and its catapults were under repair. So the miracle had happened. They were alive and free, and they had the greatest find of all his pilgrimage. He shouted joy so loud that Jacques Ramafan cowered, and the sound echoed back from the green and snow-patched hills. Chapter 5 Jeffrey Alshendott had few clear memories of the ambush and saw none of the violence. There had been the noises outside, and Mom's terrified voice screaming for him to stay inside. Then there had been lots of smoke. He remembered choking, trying to crawl to clear air. He blacked out. When he woke, he was strapped onto some sort of first aid cot, with the big dog creatures all around. They looked so funny with their white jackets and braid. He remembered wondering where their owners were.
They made the strangest noises, gobbling, buzzing, hissing. Some of it was so high-pitched he could barely hear it. For a while he was on a boat, then on a wheeled cart. Before this, he had only seen pictures of castles, but the place they took him was the real thing, its towers dark and overhanging, its big stone walls sharply angled. They climbed through shadowed streets that went scumpety-scumpety beneath the cart's wheels. The long-necked dogs hadn't hurt him, but the straps were awfully tight. He couldn't sit up. He couldn't see to the sides. He asked about Mom and Dad and Johanna, and he cried a little. A long snout appeared by his face, the soft nose pushing at his cheek. There was a buzzing sound he felt all the way down to his bones. He couldn't tell if the gesture was comfort or threat, but he gasped and tried to stop the tears. They didn't befit a good Straumer anyway. Now he saw more white-jacketed dogs, one with silly shoulder patches of gold and silver. His cot was being dragged again, this time down a torch-lit tunnel. They stopped by a double door, 2 meters wide but scarcely one high. A pair of metal triangles was set in the blonde wood. Later, Jeffrey learned they signified a number, 15 or 33, depending on whether you counted by legs or foreclaws. Much, much later, he learned that his keeper had counted by legs and the builder of the castle by foreclaws. Thus he ended up in the wrong room. It was a mistake that would change the history of worlds. Somehow the dogs opened the doors and dragged Jeffrey in. They clustered around the cot, their snouts tugging loose his restraints. He had a glimpse of rows of needle-sharp teeth. The gobbling and buzzing was very loud. When Jeffrey sat up, they backed off. Two of them held the doors as the other four exited. The doors slammed shut and the circus act was gone. Jeffrey stared at the doors for a long moment. He knew it was no circus act. The dog things must be intelligent. Somehow they had surprised his parents and sister. Where are they? He almost started to cry again. He hadn't seen them by the spaceship. They must have been captured too. They were all being held prisoner in this castle, but in separate dungeons. Somehow they must find each other. He climbed to his feet, swayed dizzily for a moment. Everything still smelled like smoke. It didn't matter. It was time to start working on getting out. He walked around the room. It was huge and not like any dungeon he'd seen in stories. The ceiling was very high, an arching dome. It was cut by 12 vertical slots. Sunlight fell in a dust-moted stream from one of them, splashing off the padded wall. It was the room's only illumination, but more than enough on this sunny day. Low-railed balconies stuck out from the four corners of the room just below the dome. He could see doors in the walls behind them. Heavy scrolls hung by the side of each balcony. There was writing on them, really big print. He walked to the wall and felt the stiff fabric. The letters were painted on. The only way you could change the display was by rubbing it out. Wow. Just like olden times on New Yora, before Straumly Realm. The baseboard below the scrolls was black stone, glossy. Someone had used scraps of chalk to draw on it. The stick figure dogs were crude. They reminded Jeffrey of pictures little kids draw in kinder school. He stopped, remembering all the children they had left aboard the boat and on the ground around it. Just a few days ago, he'd been playing with them at the High Lab School. The last year had been so strange, boring, and adventurous at the same time. The barracks had been fun with all the families together, but the grown-ups hardly ever had time to play. At night, the sky was so different from Straum's. "We're beyond the beyond," Mom had said, "making God." When she first said it, she laughed. Later, when people said it, they seemed more and more scared. The last hours had been crazy, the cold sleep drills finally for real. All his friends were in those boxes. He wept into the awful silence. There was no one to hear, no one to help him. After a few moments, he was thinking again. If the dogs didn't try to open the boxes, his friends should be okay. If Mom and Dad could make the dogs understand. strange furniture was scattered around the room, low tables and cabinets and racks like kids' jungle gyms, all made from the same blonde wood as the doors. Black pillows lay around the widest table. That one was littered with scrolls, all full of writing and still drawings. He walked the length of one wall, 10 meters or so. The stone flooring ended. There was a 2x2 bed of gravel where the walls met. Something smelled even stronger than smoke here. A bathroom smell. Jeffrey laughed. They really were like dogs. The padded walls soaked up his laughter, echoless. Something made Jeffrey look up and across the room. He'd just assumed he was alone here. In fact, there were lots of hiding places in this dungeon. For a moment, he held his breath and listened. All was silent. Almost. At the top of his hearing, up where some machines weep, and Mom and Dad and even Johanna couldn't hear, there was something.
I know you're here,
Jeffrey said sharply, his voice squeaking. He stepped sideways a few paces, trying to see around the furniture without approaching it. The sound continued, obvious now that he was listening to it. A small head with great dark eyes looked around the cabinet. It was much smaller than the creatures that had brought Jeffrey here, but the shape of the muzzle was the same. They stared at each other for a moment, and then Jeffrey edged slowly toward it. A puppy? The head withdrew, then came further out. From the corner of his eye, Jeffrey saw something move. Another of the black forms was peering at him from under the table. Jeffrey froze for a second, fighting panic. But there was no place to run, and maybe the creatures would help find Mom. Jeffrey dropped to one knee and slowly extended his hand.
Here. Here, doggy.
The puppy crawled from beneath the table, its eyes never leaving Jeffrey's hand. The fascination was mutual. The puppy was beautiful. Considering all the thousands of years that dogs have been bred by humans and others, this could have been some oddball breed, but only just. The hair was short and dense, a deep velour of black and white. The two tones lay in broad swaths with no intermediate grays. This one's entire head was black, its haunches split between white and black. The tail was a short, unimpressive flap covering its rear. There were hairless patches on its shoulders and head where Jeffrey could see black skin. But the strangest thing was the long, supple neck. It would look more natural in a simul than a dog. Jeffrey wiggled his fingers and the puppy's eyes widened, revealing an edge of white around the iris. Something bumped his elbow and Jeffrey almost jumped to his feet. So many. Two more had crept up to look at his hand. And where he had seen the first one, there were now three sitting alertly watching. Seen in the open, there was nothing unfriendly or scary about them. One of the puppies put a paw on Jeffrey's wrist and pressed gently downward. At the same time, another extended its muzzle and licked Jeffrey's fingers. The tongue was pink and raspy, a round, narrow thing. The high-pitched weeping got stronger. All three moved in, grabbing at his hand with their mouths.
"Be careful,"
Jeffrey said, jerking back his hand. He remembered the grown-up's teeth. Suddenly, the air was full of gobbling and buzzing. Humph! They sounded more like goofy birds than dogs. One of the other pups came forward. It extended a sleek nose toward Jeffrey.
"Be careful,"
it said, a perfect playback of the boy's voice. Yet its mouth was closed. It angled its neck back. To be petted? He reached out. The fur was so soft. The buzzing was very loud now. Jeffrey could feel it through the fur. But it wasn't just the one animal who was making it. The sound came from all directions. The puppy reversed direction, sliding its muzzle across the boy's hand. This time he let the mouth close on his fingers. He could see teeth all right, but the puppy carefully kept them from touching Jeffrey's skin. The tip of its snout felt like a pair of small fingers closing and opening around his. Three slipped under his other arm, like they wanted to be petted too.
He felt noses poking at his back, trying to pull his shirt out of his pants. The effort was remarkably coordinated, almost as if a two-handed human had grabbed his shirt. Just how many are there? For a moment he forgot where he was, forgot to be cautious. He rolled over and began petting the marauders. A surprised squeaking sound came from all directions. Two crawled beneath his elbows. At least three jumped on his back and lay with their noses touching his neck and ears. And Yeffrey had what seemed a great insight. The adult aliens had recognized he was a child. They just didn't know how old. They had put him in one of their own kinder schools. Mom and Dad were probably talking to them right now. Things were going to turn out all right after all. Lord Steele had not taken his name casually. Steele, the most modern of metals. Steele that takes the sharpest edge and never loses it. Steele that can glow red hot and yet not fail. Steele, the blade that cuts for the flenser. Steele was a crafted person, Flenser's greatest success. In some sense, the crafting of souls was nothing new. Brood kenning was a limited form of it, though mainly concerned with gross physical characteristics. Even kenners agreed that a pack's mental abilities derived from its various members in different measures. One pair or a triple was almost always responsible for eloquence, another for spatial intuition. The virtues and vices were even more complex. No single member was the principal source of courage or of conscience. Flenser's contribution to the field, as to most others, had been an essential ruthlessness, a cutting away of all but the truly important. He experimented endlessly, discarding all but the most successful results. He depended on discipline and denial and partial death as much as on clever member selection. He already had 70 years of experience when he created Steele. Before he could take his name, Steele spent years in denial, determining just what parts of him combined to produce the being desired. That would have been impossible without Flenser's enforcement. Example, if you dismissed a part of yourself essential for tenacity, where could you get the will to continue the flensing? For the soul in creation, the process was mental chaos, a patchwork of horror and amnesia. In 2 years, he had experienced more change than most people do in 2 centuries, and all of it directed. The turning point came when he and Flenser identified the trio that weighed him down with both conscience and slowness of intellect. One of the three bridged the others, sending it into silence, replacing it with just the right element, had made the difference. After that, the rest was easy. Steele was born. When Flenser had left to convert the Long Lakes Republic, it was only natural that his most brilliant creation should take over here. For 5 years, Steele had ruled Flenser's heartland. In that time, he had not only conserved what Flenser built, he extended it beyond the cautious beginnings. But today, in a single circling of the sun about Hidden Island, he could lose everything. Steele stepped into the meeting hall and looked around. Refreshments were properly set. Sunlight streamed from a ceiling slit onto just the place he wanted. Part of Shrek, his aide, stood on the far side of the room. He said to it, "I will speak with the visitor alone." He did not use the name Flenser. The White Jackets groveled back, and its unseen members pushed open the far doors. A fivesome, 3 males and 2 females, walked through the doorway into the splash of sunlight. The individual was unremarkable, but then Flenser had never had an imposing appearance. 2 heads raised to shade the eyes of the others. The pack looked across the room, spotting Lord Steele 20 yards away.
"Ah, Steele."
The voice was gentle, like a scalpel petting the short hairs of your throat. Steele had bowed when the other entered, a formal gesture. The voice caused a sudden cramp in his guts, and he involuntarily brought bellies to the ground. That was his voice. There was at least a fragment of the original Flenser in this pack. The gold and silver epaulettes,
the personal banner, those could be faked by anyone with suicidal bravado. But Steele remembered the manner. He wasn't surprised that the other's presence had destroyed discipline on the mainland this morning. The pack's heads, where they were in sunlight, were expressionless. Was a smile playing about the heads in shadow?
Where are the others, Steele? What happened today is the greatest opportunity of our history.
Steele got off his bellies and stood at the railing.
Sir, there are some questions first, just between the two of us. Clearly you are much of Flenser, but how much?
The other was clearly grinning now, the shadowed heads bobbing.
Yes, I knew my best creation would see that question. This morning I claimed to be the true Flenser, improved with one or two replacements. The truth is, harder. You know about the Republic.
That had been Flenser's greatest gamble, to flense an entire nation-state. Millions would die, yet even so there would be more molding than killing. In the end, there would exist the first collective outside of the tropics, and the Flenser state would not be a mindless agglomeration grubbing about in some jungle. The top would be as brilliant, as ruthless as any packs in history. No people in the world could stand against such a force.
It was an awesome risk to take for an even more awesome goal. But I took precautions. We had thousands of converts, many of them people with no understanding of our true ambition, but faithful and self-sacrificing, as they should be. I always kept a special group of them nearby. The political police were clever to use mob assassination against me, the last thing I had expected, I who made the mobs. No matter, my bodyguards were well trained. When we were trapped in Parliament Bowl, they killed one or two members of each of those special packs, and I simply ceased to exist, dispersed among three panicky, ordinary people trying to escape the blood swamp.
But everyone around you was killed. The mob left no one.
The Flenser thing shrugged.
That was partly Republican propaganda and partly my own work. I ordered my guards to hack each other down, along with everyone who was not me.
Steele almost voiced his awe. The plan was typical of Flenser's brilliance and his strength of soul. In assassinations, there was always the chance that fragments would get away. There were famous stories of heroes reassembled. In real life, such events were rare, usually happening when the victim's forces could sustain their leader through reintegration. But Flenser had planned this tactic from the beginning, had envisaged reassembling himself more than 1,000 miles from the Long Lakes. Still, Lord Steele looked at the other in calculation. Ignore voice and manner. Think for power, not for the desires of others, even Flenser. Steele recognized only two in the other pack. The females and the male with the white-tipped ears were probably from the sacrificed follower. Very likely only really two of Flenser faced him, scarcely a threat, except in the very real sense of appearances.
And the other four of you, sir? When may we expect your entire presence?
The Flenser thing chuckled. Damaged as it was, it still understood balance of power. This was almost like the old days, when two people have a clear understanding of power and betrayal, then betrayal itself becomes almost impossible. There is only the ordered flow of events, bringing good to those who deserve to rule.
The others have equally good mounts. I made detailed plans, three different paths, three different sets of agents. I arrived safely. I have no doubt the others will, too, in a few 10 days at most. Until then,
he turned all heads toward Steele.
Until then, dear Steele, I do not claim the full role of Flenser. I did so earlier to establish priorities, to protect this fragment till I am assembled, but this pack is deliberately weak-minded. I know it wouldn't survive as the ruler of my earlier creations.
Steele wondered. Half-brained, the creature's schemes were perfect. Nearly perfect. So you wish a background role for the next few 10 days? Very well. But you announced yourself as Flenser. How shall I present you? The other didn't hesitate.
Tyrefect, Flenser in waiting.
Crypto, 0. As received by Transceiver Relay 03 at Relay. Language path, Somnorsh to Trisqualine. SJK, Relay Units. From Stroumley, Maine. Subject, Archive opened in the low transcend. Summary, our links to the known net will be down temporarily. Key phrases, transcend, good news, business opportunities, new archive, communications problems. Distribution. Where are they now, interest group? Homo sapiens interest group. Motley Hatch administration group. Transceiver Relay 03 at Relay. Transceiver Wendsong at Deadly Down. Transceiver Not For Long at Shortstop. Date, 11 hours, 45 minutes, 20 seconds, docs time. 01/09 of Orgear, 52089. Text of message. We are proud to announce that a human exploration company from Stroumley Realm has discovered an accessible archive in the low transcend. This is not an announcement of transcendence or the creation of a new power. We have, in fact, postponed this announcement until we were sure of our property rights and the safety of the archive. We have installed interfaces which should make the archive interoperable with standard syntax queries from the net. In a few days, this access will be made commercially available. See discussion of scheduling problems below. Because of its safety, intelligibility, and age, this archive is remarkable. We believe there is otherwise lost information here about arbitration management and inter-race coordination. We'll send details to the appropriate news groups. We're very excited about this. Note that no interaction with the powers was necessary. No part of Stroumley Realm has transcended. Now for the bad news. Arbitration and translation schemes have had unfortunate clinerations, with the Ridgeway armiflage, The details should be amusing to the people in the Communication Threats News Group, and we will report them there later. But for at least the next 100 hours, all our links, main and minor, to the known net will be down. Incoming messages may be buffered, but no guarantees. No messages can be forwarded. We regret this inconvenience and will make up for it very soon. Physical commerce is in no way affected by these problems. Stroumley Realm continues to welcome tourists and trade. Chapter 6. Looking back, Ravna Berkshendot saw it was inevitable that she become a librarian. As a child on Chandra K, she had been in love with stories from the age of princesses. There was adventure, a time when a few brave ladies had dragged humankind to greatness. She and her sister had spent countless afternoons pretending to be the greater two and rescuing the Countess of the Lake. Later they understood that Nuyora and its princesses were lost in the dim past. Sister Luna turned to more practical things, but Ravna still wanted adventure. Through her teens, she had dreamed of emigrating to Stroumley Realm. That was something very real. Imagine, a new and mostly human colony right at the top of the beyond. And Stroum welcomed folk from the mother world. Their enterprise was less than 100 years old. They or their children would be the first humans anywhere in the galaxy to transcend their own humanity. She might end up a god and richer than 1,000,000 beyonder worlds. It was a dream real enough to provoke constant arguments with her parents. For where there is heaven, there can also be hell. Stroumley Realm kissed close to the transcend, and the people there played with the tigers that paced beyond the bars. Dad had actually used that tired image. The disagreement drove them apart for several years. Then, in her computer science and applied theology courses, Ravna began to read about some of the old horrors. Maybe, she should be a little more cautious. Better to look around first. And there was a way to see into everything that humans in the beyond could possibly understand. Ravna became a librarian.
The ultimate dilettante, Len had teased.
It's true, and so what? Ravna had grumped back. But the dream of far traveling was not quite dead in her. Life in Hertha University at Chandra K should have been perfect for her. Things might have gone on happily for a lifetime there, except that in her graduation year, there had been the Vrinimi organization's faraway Prentice contest. 3 years work-study at the archive by relay was the prize. Winning was the chance of a lifetime. She would come back with more experience than any local academician. So it was that Ravna Bergschendott ended up more than 20,000 light-years from home at the network hub of a million worlds. Sunset was an hour past when Ravna drifted across City Park toward Grandir Vrinimikalir's residence. She'd been on the planet only a handful of times since arriving in the relay system. Most of her work was at the archives themselves, 1,000 light-hours out. This part of Groundside was in early autumn, though twilight had faded the tree colors to bands of gray. From Ravna's altitude, 100 meters up, the air had the nip of frosts to come. Between her feet she could see picnic fires and gaming fields. The Vrinimi organization didn't spend much on the planet, but the world was beautiful. As long as she kept her eyes on the darkening ground, Ravna could almost imagine this was someplace in her home terrain on Chandra K. Look into the sky, though, and you knew you were far from home. 20,000 light-years away, the galactic whirlpool sprawled up toward the zenith. It was just a faint thing in the twilight, and it might not get much brighter this night. Low in the western sky, a cluster of N-system factories glowed brighter than any moon. The operation was a brilliant flickering of stars and rays, sometimes so intense that stark shadows were cast eastwards from the City Park mountains. In another half hour, the docks would rise. The docks weren't as bright as the factories, but together they would outshine anything from the far stars. She shifted in her grav harness, drifting lower. The scent of autumn and picnics came stronger. Suddenly the click of collier laughter was all around her. She had blundered into an airball game. Ravna spread her arms in mock humiliation and dodged out of the player's way. Her stroll through the park was just about over. She could see her destination ahead. Grandir Collier's residence was a rarity in the City Park landscape, a recognizable building. It dated from when the org bought into the relay operation. Seen from just 80 meters up, the house was a blocky silhouette against the sky. When factory lights flashed, the smooth walls of the monolith glowed an oily tense. Grandir was her boss's boss. She had talked to him exactly 3 times in 2 years. No more delay. Nervous and very curious, Ravna floated lower and let the house electronics guide her across the tree decks toward an entrance. Grandir Vrinimikalir treated her with standard organization courtesy, the common denominator that surfed between the several races of the org. The meeting room had furniture suitable for human and Vrinimi use. There were refreshments and questions about her job at the archive.
"Mixed results, sir," Ravna replied honestly. "I've learned a great deal. The apprenticeship is everything it's claimed to be. But I'm afraid the new division is going to require an added index layer."
All this was in reports the old fellow could have seen at the flick of a digit. Grandir rubbed a hand absently across his eye freckles. "Yes, an expected disappointment. We're at the limits of information management with this expansion. Egravan and Derka, those were Ravna's boss and boss's boss, are quite happy with your progress. You came well-educated and learned fast. I think there's a place for humans in the organization.
Thank you, sir. Ravna blushed.
Grander's assessment was casually spoken, but very important to her. And it would probably mean the arrival of more humans, perhaps even before her apprenticeship was up. So was this the reason for the interview? She tried not to stare at the other. She was quite used to the Vrini-Me majority race by now. From a distance, the collier looked humanoid. Up close, the differences were substantial. The race was descended from something like an insect. In upsizing, evolution had necessarily moved reinforcing struts inside the body till the outside was a combination of grub-like skin and sheets of pale chitin. At first glance, Grander was an unremarkable exemplar of the race. But when the fellow moved, even to adjust his jacket or scratch at his eye freckles, there was a strange precision to him. Egravan said that he was very, very old. Grander changed the subject with clickety abruptness. You are aware of the changes at Straumly Realm?
You mean the fall of Straum? Yes.
Though I'm surprised you are. Straumly Realm was a significant human civilization, but it accounted for only an infinitesimal fraction of Relay's message traffic. Please accept my sympathy. Despite the cheerful announcements from Straum, it was clear that absolute disaster had befallen Straumly Realm. Almost every race eventually dabbled in the Transcend, more often than not becoming a superintelligence, a power. But it was clear by now that the Straumers had created or awakened a power of deadly inclination. Their fate was as terrible as anything Ravna's father had ever predicted. And their bad luck was now a disaster that stretched across all that had been Straumly Realm. Grander continued, "Will this news affect your work?" Curiouser and curiouser. She would have sworn the other was coming to the point. Maybe this was the point.
No, sir. The Straumly affair is a terrible thing, especially for humankind. But my home is Chandra K. Straumly Realm is our offspring, but I have no relatives there.
Though I might have been there if it hadn't been for Mother and Dad. Actually, when Straumly Main dropped off the net, Chandra K. had been unreachable for almost 40 hours. That had bothered her very much, since any rerouting should have been immediate. Communication was eventually established. The problem had been screwed up, routing tables on an alternate path. Ravna had even shot half a year's savings for an over-and-back mailing. Luna and her parents were fine. The Straumly debacle was the news of the century for folks at Chandra K., but it was still a disaster at great remove. Ravna wondered if parents had ever given better advice than hers had. Good, good. His mouth parts moved in the analog of a human nod. His head tilted so only peripheral freckles were looking at her. The guy actually seemed hesitant. Ravna looked back silently. Grander Collier might be the strangest exec in the org. He was the only one whose principal residence was Groundside. Officially, he was in charge of a division of the Archives. In fact, he ran Vrini-Me Marketing. That is, intelligence. There were stories that he had visited the top of the Beyond. Egravan claimed he had an artificial immune system. You see, the Straumly disaster has incidentally made you one of the organization's most valuable employees.
I don't understand.
Ravna, the rumors in the Threats news group are true. The Straumers had a laboratory in the Low Transcend. They were playing with recipes from some lost archive, and they created a new power. It appears to be a Class 2 perversion. The known net recorded a Class 2 perversion about once a century. Such powers had a normal lifespan, about 10 years. But they were explicitly malevolent, and in 10 years could do enormous damage. Poor Straum.
So you can see there's enormous potential for profit or loss here. If the disaster spreads, we will lose network customers. On the other hand, everyone around Stroumly Realm wants to track what is happening. This could increase our message traffic by several percent.
Gronder put it more cold-bloodedly than she liked, but he had a point. In fact, the opportunity for profit was directly linked with mitigating the perversion. If she hadn't been so wrapped up in archive work, she'd have guessed all this. And now that she did think about it...
There are even more spectacular opportunities. Historically, these perversions have been of interest to other powers. They'll want net feeds and information about the creating race.
Her voice guttered into silence as she finally understood the reason for this meeting. Gronder's mouthparts clicked agreement.
Indeed, we at Relay are well placed to supply news to the Transcend, and we also have our own human. In the last 3 days, we've received several dozen queries from civilizations in the high beyond, some claiming to represent powers. This interest could mean a large increase in organization income through the next decade. All this you could read in the Threats News Group. But there is another item, something I ask you to keep secret for now. 5 days ago, a ship from the Transcend entered our region. It claims to be directly controlled by a power.
The wall behind him became a window upon the visitor. The craft was an irregular collection of spines and lumps. A scale bar claimed the thing was only 5 meters across. Ravna felt the hair on her neck prickling. Here in the middle beyond, they should be relatively safe from the caprice of the powers. Still, the visit was an unnerving thing.
What does it want?
Information about the Stroumly perversion. In particular, it is very interested in your race. It would give a great deal to take back a living human.
Ravna's response was abrupt.
I'm not interested.
Gronder spread his pale hands. The light glittered from the chitin on the back of his fingers.
It would be an enormous opportunity. Apprenticeship with the gods. This one has promised to establish an oracle here in return.
No.
Ravna half rose from her chair. She was one human, more than 20,000 light years from home. That had been a frightening thing in the first days of her apprenticeship. Since then, she had made friends, had learned more of organization ethics, had come to trust these folk almost as much as people at Chandra K. But there was only one halfway trustable oracle on the net these days, and it was almost 10 years old. This power was tempting Vrini Me Org with fabulous treasure. Gronder clicked embarrassment. He waved her back to her chair.
It was only a suggestion. We do not abuse our employees. If you will simply serve as our local expert...
Ravna nodded.
Good. Frankly, I had not expected you to accept the offer. We have a much more likely volunteer, but one who needs coaching.
A human? Here?
Ravna had a standing query in the local directory for other humans. During the last 2 years, she had seen 3, and they had just been passing through.
How long has she... He been here?
Gronder said something halfway between a smile and a laugh.
A bit more than a century, though we didn't realize it until a few days ago.
The pictures around him shifted. Ravna recognized Relay's attic, the junkyard of abandoned ships and freight devices that floated just 1,000 light seconds from the archives.
We receive a lot of one-way freight, items shipped in the hope we'll buy or sell on consignment.
The view closed on a decrepit vessel, perhaps 200 meters long, wasp-waisted to support a ram-scoop drive. Its ultra-drive spines were scarcely more than stubs.
A bottom lugger? Said Ravna.
Gronder clicked negation.
A dredge. The ship is about 30,000 years old. Most of that time was spent in a deep penetration of the slow zone and 10,000 years in the unthinking depths.
Up close now, she could see the hull was finely pitted, the result of millennia of relativistic erosion. Even unpiloted, such expeditions were rare. A deep penetration could not return to the beyond within the lifetime of its builders. Some would not return within the lifetime of the builder's race. People who launched such missions were just a little weird. People who recovered them could make a solid profit. This one came from very far away, even if it's not quite a jackpot mission. It didn't see anything interesting in the unthinking depths, not surprising given that even simple automation fails there. We sold most of the cargo immediately. The rest we cataloged and forgot, till the Stromley affair. The starscape vanished. They were looking at a medical display, random limbs and body parts. They looked very human. In a solar system at the bottom of the slowness, the dredge found a derelict. The wreck had no ultra-drive capability. It was truly a slow-zone design. The solar system was uninhabited. We speculate the ship had a structural failure, or perhaps the crew was affected by the depths. Either way, they ended up in a frozen mangle. Tragedy at the bottom of the slowness thousands of years ago. Ravna forced her eyes from the carnage.
You figure on selling this to our visitor?
Even better. Once we started poking around, we discovered a substantial error in the cataloging. One of the debtors is almost intact. We patched it up with parts from the others. It was expensive, but we ended up with a living human.
The picture flickered again, and Ravna caught her breath. In the medical animation, the parts floated into an orderly arrangement. There was a complete body there, torn up a little in the belly. Pieces came together, and this was no she. He floated whole and naked as if in sleep. Ravna had no doubt of his humanity, but all humankind in the beyond was descended from Nuyoran stock. This fellow had none of that heritage. The skin was smoky gray, not brown. The hair was bright reddish-brown, a color she had only seen in pre-Nuyoran histories. The bones of the face were subtly different from modern humans. The small differences were more jarring than the outright alienness of her co-workers. Now the figure was clothed. Under other circumstances, Ravna would have smiled. Grandir Collier had picked an absurd costume, something from the Nuyoran era. The figure bore a sword and slug gun, a sleeping prince from the age of princesses.
"Behold the Ur-Human," said Grandir.
Chapter 7. Relay is a common place name. It has meaning in almost any environment. Like Newtown and New Home, it occurs over and over when people move or colonize or participate in a communications net. You could travel a billion light years or a billion years and still find such names among races of natural intelligence. But in the current era, there was one instance of relay known above all others. That instance appeared in the routing list of 2% of all traffic across the known net. 20,000 light-years off the galactic plane, Relay had an unobstructed line of sight on 30% of the beyond, including many star systems right at the bottom, where starships can make only one light-year per day. A few metal-bearing solar systems were equally well-placed, and there was competition. But where other civilizations lost interest or colonized into the transcend or died an apocalypse, Vrinimi organization lasted. After 50,000 years, there were several races of the original org in its membership. None of those were still leaders, yet the original viewpoint and policies remained. Position and durability. Relay was now the main intermediate to the Magellanics, and one of the few sites with any sort of link to the beyond in the Sculptor Galaxy. At Chandra K, Relay's reputation had been fabulous. In her 2 years of apprenticeship, Ravna had come to realize that the truth exceeded the reputation. Relay was in middle beyond. The organization's only export was the relay function and access to the local archive. Yet they imported the finest biologicals and processing equipment from the high beyond. The relay docks were an extravagance that only the absolutely rich could indulge. They stretched 1,000 kilometers, bays, repair holds, transshipment centers, parks, and playgrounds. Even at Chandra Cay, there were habitats far larger. But the docks were in no orbit. They floated 1,000 kilometers above groundside on the largest agrav frame Ravna had ever seen. At Chandra Cay, the annual income of an academician might pay for a square meter of agrav fabric, junk that might not last a year. Here there were millions of hectares of the stuff, supporting billions of tons. Just replacements for dead fabric required more high beyond commerce than most star clusters could command. And now I have my own office here. Working directly for Grandeur Collier had its perks. Ravna kicked back in her chair and stared across the central sea. At the dock's altitude, gravity was still about 3/4 of a G. Air fountains hung a breathable atmosphere over the middle part of the platform. The day before, she had taken a sailboat across the clear-bottomed sea. That was a strange experience indeed. Planetary clouds below your keel, stars and indigo sky above. She had the surf cranked up this morning, an easy matter of flexing the agravs of the basin. It made a regular crashing against her beach. Even 30 meters from the water, there was a tang of salt in the air. Rows of white tops marched off into the distance. She eyed the figure that was trudging slowly up the beach toward her. Just a few weeks ago, she would never have dreamed this situation. Just a few weeks ago, she had been out at the archive, absorbed in the upgrade work, happy to be involved with one of the largest databases on the known net. Now, it was almost as if she had come full circle back to her childhood dreams of adventure. The only problem was that sometimes she felt like one of the villains. Fom Nguyen was a living person, not something to be sold. She stood and walked out to meet her red-haired visitor. He wasn't carrying the sword and handgun of Grandeur's fanciful animation. Yet his clothes were the braided fabric of ancient adventure, and he carried himself with lazy confidence. Since her meeting with Grandeur, she had looked up some anthropology from old Earth. The red hair and the eye folds had been known there, though rarely in the same individual. Certainly his smoky skin would have been remarkable to an inhabitant of Earth. This fellow was, as much as herself, a product of post-terrestrial evolution. He stopped in arm's length away and gave her a lopsided grin. "You look pretty human, Ravna Bergshendot." She smiled and nodded up at him.
"Mr. Fom Nguyen."
"Yes, indeed. We seem both to be excellent guessers." He swept past her into the shade of the inner office. Cocky fellow. She followed him, unsure about protocol. You'd think with a fellow human, there would be no problems. Actually, the interview went pretty smoothly. It was more than 30 days since Fom Nguyen's resuscitation. Much of that time had been spent in cram language sessions. The fellow must be damned bright. He already spoke Trisqualine trade talk with a folksy slickness. He really was rather cute. Ravna had been away from Chandra Cay for 2 years and had another year of her apprenticeship to go. She'd been doing pretty well. She had many close friends here, Egravan, Sarale. But just chatting with this fellow brought a lot of the loneliness back. In some ways, he was more alien than anything at Relay. And in some ways, she wanted to just grab him and kiss his confident grin away. Grandeur Vrini Mikolir had been telling the truth about this Fom Nguyen. The guy was actually enthusiastic about the org's plans for him. In theory, that meant she could do her job with a clear conscience. In fact,
"Mr. Nguyen, my job is to orient you to your new world. I know you've been exposed to some intense instruction the last few days, but there are limits to how fast such knowledge can sink in."
The redhead smiled. "Call me Fom. Sure, I feel like an overstuffed bag. My sleep time is full of little voices. I've learned an awful lot without experiencing anything. Worse, I've been a target for all this education. It's a perfect setup if Vrini me wants to trick me. That's why I'm learning to use the local library. And that's why I insisted they find someone like you. He saw the surprise on her face. Ha! You didn't know that. See, talking to a real person gives me a chance to see things that aren't all planned ahead. Also, I've always been a pretty good judge of human nature. I think I can read you pretty well. His grin showed he understood just how irritating he was being. Ravna looked up at the green petals of the beech trees. Maybe this boob deserved what he was getting into.
So you have great experience dealing with people?
Given the limitations of the slowness, I've been around, Ravna. I've been around. I know I don't look it, but I'm 67 years old, subjective. I thank your organization for a fine job of thawing me out. He tipped a non-existent hat in her direction. My last voyage was more than 1,000 years objective. I was programmer-at-arms on a Cheng Ho long shot.
His eyes abruptly widened, and he said something unintelligible. For a moment, he almost looked vulnerable. Ravna reached a hand toward him. Memory?
Fom Nguyen nodded. Damn, this is something I don't thank you people for.
Fom Nguyen had been frozen in the aftermath of violent death, not as a planned suspension. It was a near miracle that Vrini Mi Org had been able to bring him back at all, at least with middle beyond technology. But memory was the hardest thing. The chemical basis of memory does not survive chaotic freezing well. The problem was enough to shrink even Fom Nguyen's ego by a size or two. Ravna took pity on him.
It's not likely that anything is completely lost. You just have to find a different angle on some things.
Yes, I've been coached about that. Start with other memories. Work sideways toward what you can't remember straight on. Well, it beats being dead.
Some of his jauntiness returned, but subdued to a really quite charming level. They talked for a long while as the redhead worked around the points he couldn't remember straight on. And gradually, Ravna came to feel something she had never expected in connection with a slow zoner. Awe. In one lifetime, Fom Nguyen had accomplished virtually everything that was possible for a being in the slowness. All her life, she had pitied the civilizations trapped down there. They could never know the glory. They might never know the truth. Yet by luck and skill and sheer strength of will, this fellow had leaped barrier after barrier. Had Grandeur known the truth when he pictured the redhead with sword and slug gun? For Fom Nguyen really was a barbarian. He had been born on a fallen colony world, Canberra, he called it. The place sounded much like medieval New Yorra, though not matriarchal. He'd been the youngest child of a king. He'd grown up with swords and poison and intrigue, living in stone castles by a cold, cold sea. No doubt this littlest prince would have ended up murdered, or king of all, if life had continued in the medieval way. But when he was 13 years old, everything changed. A world that had only legends of aircraft and radio was confronted by interstellar traders. In a year of trading, Canberra's feudal politics was turned on its head.
Cheng Ho had invested 3 ships in the expedition to Canberra. They were pissed that we'd be at a higher level of technology. We couldn't resupply them, so 2 stayed behind, probably turned my poor world inside out. I left with the 3rd, a crazy hostage deal my father thought he was putting over on them. I was lucky they didn't space me.
Cheng Ho consisted of several 100 ram scoop ships operating in a volume hundreds of light years across. Their vessels could reach almost 1/3 of the speed of light. They were mostly traders, occasionally rescuers, even more rarely conquerors. When Fom Nguyen last knew them, they had settled 30 worlds and were almost 3,000 years old. It was as extravagant a civilization as can ever exist in the slowness. And, of course, until Fom Nguyen was revived, no one in the beyond had ever heard of it. Cheng Ho was like 1 million other doomed civilizations buried thousands of light years in the slowness.
Only by luck would they ever penetrate into the beyond, where faster-than-light travel was possible. But for a 13-year-old boy born to swords and chainmail, the Cheng Ho was more changed than most living beings ever experience. In a matter of weeks, he went from medieval lordling to starship cabin boy.
At first, they didn't know what to do with me. Figured on popping me into cold storage and dumping me at the next stop. What can you make of a kid who thinks there's one world and it's flat, who has spent his whole life learning to whack about with a sword?
He stopped abruptly, as he did every few minutes, when the stream of recollection ran into damaged territory. Then his glance flicked out at Ravna, and his smile was as cocky as ever.
I was one mean animal. I don't think civilized people realize what it's like to grow up with your own aunts and uncles scheming to murder you, and you training to get them first. In civilization, I met bigger villains, guys who'd fry a whole planet and call it reconciliation, but for sheer up-close treachery, you can't beat my childhood.
To hear Pham Nguyen tell it, only dumb luck saved the crew from his scheming. In the years that followed, he learned to fit in, learned civilized skills. Properly tamed, he could be an ideal shipmaster of the Cheng Ho. And for many years he was. The Cheng Ho volume contained a couple of other races and a number of human-colonized worlds. At 3/10 light speed, Pham spent decades in cold sleep getting from star to star, then a year or two at each port trying to make a profit with products and information that might be lethally out of date. The reputation of the Cheng Ho was some protection. Politics may come and go, but Greek goes on forever, was the fleet's motto, and they had lasted longer than most of their customers. Even religious fanatics grew a little cautious when they thought about Cheng Ho retribution. But more often it was the skill and deviousness of the shipmaster that saved the day, and few were a match for the little boy in Pham Nguyen.
I was almost the perfect skipper. Almost. I always wanted to see what was beyond the space we had good records on. Every time I got really rich, so rich I could launch my own subfleet, I'd take some crazy chance and lose everything. I was the yo-yo of the fleet. One run I'd be captain of five, the next I'd be pulling maintenance programming on some damn routineer. Given how time stretches out with sub-like commerce, there were whole generations who thought I was a legendary genius, and others who used my name as a synonym for goofball.
He paused, and his eyes widened in pleased surprise.
Ah, I remember what I was doing there at the end. I was in the goofball part of my cycle, but it didn't matter. There was this captain of 20 who was even crazier than I.
Can't remember her name.
Her? Couldn't have been. I'd never serve under a femme captain.
He was almost talking to himself.
Anyway, this guy was willing to bet everything on the sort of thing normal folks would argue about over beer. He called his ship the, it translates as something like Wild Witless Bird. That gives you the idea about him. He figured there must be some really high-tech civilization somewhere in the universe. The problem was to find them. In a strange way, he had almost guessed about the zones. Only problem was, he wasn't crazy enough. He got one little thing wrong. Can you guess what?
Ravna nodded. Considering where Pham's wreck was found, it was obvious.
Yeah, I'll bet it's an idea older than spaceflight. The elder races must be toward the galactic core, where stars are closer and there are black hole exotica for power. He was taking his entire fleet of 20. They'd keep going till they found somebody or had to stop and colonize. This captain figured success was unlikely in our lifetime, but with proper planning we could end up in a close-packed region where it would be easy to found a new Cheng Ho. And it would proceed even further. Anyway, I was lucky to get aboard even as a programmer, This captain knew all the wrong things about me.
The expedition lasted 1,000 years, penetrating 250 light-years galactic inward. The Cheng Ho volume was closer to the bottom of the slowness than old Earth, and they were proceeding inwards from there. Even so, it was plain bad luck that they encountered the edge of the deeps after only 250 light-years. One after another, the wild, witless bird lost contact with the other ships. Sometimes it happened without warning. Other times there was evidence of computer failure or gross incompetence. The survivors saw a pattern, guessed that common components were failing. Of course, no one connected the problems with the region of space they were entering.
We backed down from ram speeds, found a solar system with a semi-habitable planet. We'd lost track of everybody else. Just what we did then isn't real clear to me. He gave a dry laugh. We must have been right at the edge, staggering around at about IQ 60. I remember fooling with the life support system. That's probably what actually killed us.
For a moment, he looked sad and bewildered. He shrugged.
And then I woke up in the tender clutches of Vrini Miorg. Here, where faster than light travel is possible, and I can see the edge of heaven itself.
Ravna didn't say anything for a moment. She looked across her beach into the surf. They'd been talking a long time. The sun was peeking under the tree petals, its light shifting across her office. Did Gronder realize what he had here? Almost anything from the slow zone had collector's value. People, fresh from the slowness, were even more valuable. But Von Neuen might be unique. He had personally experienced more than had some whole civilizations, and he had ventured into the deeps to boot. She understood now why he looked to the transcend and called it heaven. It wasn't entirely naivete, nor a failure in the organization's education programs. Von Neuen had already been through 2 transforming experiences, from pre-tech to star traveler, and star traveler to beyonder. Each was a jump almost beyond imagination. Now he saw that another step was possible and was perfectly willing to sell himself to take it. So why should I risk my job to change his mind? But her mouth was living a life of its own.
Why not postpone the transcend, Fom? Take some time to understand what is here in the beyond. You'd be welcome in almost any civilization, and on human worlds you'd be the wonder of the age.
A glimpse of non-New Yoran humanity. The local news groups at Chandra K had thought Ravna radically ambitious to take apprenticeship 20,000 light-years away. Coming back from it, she would have her pick of full academician jobs on any of a dozen worlds. That was nothing compared to Von Neuen. There were folks so rich they might give him a world if he would just stay.
You could name your price.
The redhead's lazy smile broadened.
Ah, but you see, I've already named my price, and I think Vrini Me can meet it.
I really wish I could do something about that smile, thought Ravna. Von Neuen's ticket to the Transcend was based on a power's sudden interest in the Straumli perversion.
This innocent's ego might end up smeared across 1,000,000 death cubes, running 1,000,000,000 simulations of human nature.
Gronder called less than 5 minutes after Von Neuen's departure. Ravna knew the org would be eavesdropping, and she'd already told Gronder her misgivings about this selling of a softant. Nevertheless, she was a bit nervous to see him.
When is he actually going to leave for the Transcend?
Gronder rubbed at his freckles. He didn't seem angry.
Not for 10 or 20 days. The power that's negotiating for him is more interested in looking at our archives and watching what's passing through relay. Also, despite the human's enthusiasm for going, he's really quite cautious.
Oh?
Yes. He's insisting on a library budget and permission to roam anywhere in the system. He's been chatting with random employees all over the docks. He was especially insistent about talking to you.
Gronder's mouth parts clicked in a smile. Feel free to speak your mind to him. Basically, he's tasting around for hidden poison. Hearing the worst from you should make him trust us. She was coming to understand Gronder's confidence. Damn, but Fon Nguyen had a thick head.
Yes, sir. He's asked me to show him around the foreign quarter tonight.
As you well know. Fine. I wish the rest of the deal were going as smoothly. Gronder turned so that only peripheral freckles were looking in her direction. He was surrounded by status displays of the org's communication and database operations. From what she could see, things were remarkably busy. Maybe I should not bring this up, but it's just possible you can help. Business is very brisk. Gronder did not seem pleased to report the good news. We have 9 civilizations from the top of the beyond that are bidding for wideband data feeds. That we could handle. But this power that sent a ship here... Ravna interrupted almost without thinking, a breach that would have horrified her a few days earlier.
Just who is it, by the way? Any chance we're entertaining the Straumly perversion?
The thought of that taking the redhead was a chill. Not unless all the powers are fooled, too. Marketing calls our current visitor Old One. He smiled. That's something of a joke, but true even so. We've known it for 11 years. No one really knew how long transcendent beings lived, but it was a rare power that stayed communicative for more than 5 or 10 years. They lost interest, or grew into something different, or really did die. There were a million explanations, thousands that were allegedly from the power's first hand. Ravna guessed that the true explanation was the simplest one. Intelligence is the handmaiden of flexibility and change. Dumb animals can change only as fast as natural evolution. Human equivalent races, once on their technological run-up, hit the limits of their zone in a matter of a few thousand years. In the transcend, superhumanity can happen so fast that its creators are destroyed. It wasn't surprising, then, that the powers themselves were evanescent. So calling an 11-year-old power Old One was almost reasonable.
We believe that Old One is a variant on the Type 73 pattern. Such are rarely malicious, and we know from whom it transcended. Just now it's causing us major discomfort, though. For 20 days it has been monopolizing an enormous and increasing percentage of relay bandwidth.
Since its ship arrived, it's been all over the archive and our local nets. We've asked Old One to send non-critical data by starship, but it refuses. This afternoon was the worst yet. Almost 5% of Relay's capacity was bound up in its service, and the creature is sending almost as much downlink as it is receiving uplink. That was weird, but...
It's still paying for the business, isn't it? If Old One can pay top price, why do you care?
Ravna, we hope our organization will be around for many years after the Old One is gone. There is nothing it could offer us that would be good through all that time.
Ravna nodded. Actually, there were certain magic automations that might work down here, but their long-term effectiveness would be dubious. This was a commercial situation, not some exercise in an applied theology course.
Old One can easily top any bid from the middle beyond, but if we give it all the services it demands, we'll be effectively non-functional to the rest of our customers, and they are the people we must depend on in the future. His image was replaced by an archive access report. Ravna was very familiar with the format, and Gronder's complaint really hit home. The known net was a vast thing. A hierarchical anarchy that linked hundreds of millions of worlds. Yet even the main trunks had bandwidths like something out of Earth's Dawn Age. A RIST data set could do better on a local net. That's why bulk access to the archive was mostly local, to media freighters visiting the relay system. But now, during the last 100 hours, remote access to the archive, both by volume and by count, had been higher than local,
and 90% of those accesses were from a single account. Old ones. Gronder's voice continued from behind the graphics. We've got one backbone transceiver dedicated to this power right now. Frankly, we can't tolerate this for more than a few days. The ultimate expense is just too great. Gronder's face was back on the display. Anyway, I think you can see that the deal for the Barbarian is really the least of our problems. The last 20 days have brought more income than the last 2 years, far more than we can verify and absorb. We're endangered by our own success. He made an ironic smile frown. They talked a few minutes about Fom Nguyen, then Gronder rang off. Afterwards, Ravna took a walk along her beach. The sun was well down toward the aft horizon, and the sand was just pleasantly warm against her feet. The docks went round the planet once every 20 hours, circling the pole at about 40 degrees north latitude. She walked close to the surf, where the sand was flat and wet. The mist off the sea was moist against her skin. The blue sky just above the white tops shaded quickly to indigo and black. Specks of silver moved up there, a grav floaters bringing starships into the docks. The whole thing was so fabulously, unnecessarily expensive. Ravna was by turns grossed out and bedazzled. Yet after 2 years at Relay, she was beginning to see the point. Vrinimi.org wanted the Beyond to know that it had the resources to handle whatever communication and archive demands might be made on it. And they wanted the Beyond to suspect that there were hidden gifts from the Transcend here. Things that might make it more than a little dangerous to invaders. She stared into the spray, feeling it bead on her lashes. So Gronder had the big problem right now. How do you tell a power to take a walk? All Ravna Bergschendot had to worry about was one overconfident twit who seemed hellbent on destroying himself. She turned and paralleled the water. Every third wave it surged over her ankles. She sighed. Fom Nguyen was beyond doubt a twit. But what an awesome one. Intellectually, she had always known that there was no difference in the possible intelligence of Beyonders and the primitives of the Slowness. Most automation worked better in the Beyond. Ultralight communication was possible. But you had to go to the Transcend to build truly superhuman minds. So it shouldn't be surprising that Fom Nguyen was capable. Very capable. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.